Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Every year in the U.S. criminal justice system, nearly a quarter of a million young people are imprisoned. Most of them will be released at some point, even if they're charged with murder. That's what happened to Carter Kane Reed. In 1993, when Reed was 16 years old, he was charged with killing another teenager, Jason Robinson, inside Dartmouth High School. After decades in prison, he reached out to professor, author, and activist Jean Trounstein, and they began writing to each other. Earlier this year, she wrote his story in the book Boy with a Knife, a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice. Reed was released on parole more than 3 years ago, and he now works and lives in central Massachusetts. When he and Trounstein came to our studios in April, I started by asking him what life was like in prison.
The thing about prison is, abnormal as those circumstances are, being confined against your will and being having all your freedoms stripped from you, all of the things that you desire, everything and everyone that you love, having all of that taken away, that's something that most people can't relate to. But in another sense, prison is also, it's like everyday life. You have everyday human interactions with other individuals, be they fellow prisoners, the administration, the correctional officers, the volunteers who come in to teach rehabilitative programs. Those interactions are just as human and just as important as the interactions people have in society, with the exception, and what I think has been most beneficial to my development, is they're very concentrated. Those experiences are intensified or magnified by the circumstances, because you're in such close confinement constantly. And I think that leads, if you're open to it, it leads to some revelations you may not have had an opportunity to have in society.
When many people think of being incarcerated, they're very frightened by what certainly in the media has been portrayed as a very harsh environment, very cruel environment, and not just by other folks who may be incarcerated, but by some of the folks running the facilities. I mean, is that a TV experience or is that reality?
One of the ironies kind of the situation is that prisons are definitely a microcosm of society with that kind of magnification factor. So if you think of maybe the violence, the attitudes, the hostility, all the things that exist in society, and maybe you multiply that by 10, not because the people are more aggressive, but because circumstances and conditions of confinement kind of just magnify that on their own. You put people in much closer confinement, people don't have an ability to walk away and count to 10 when they're locked inside a 6x9 cell with each other 23 out of 24 hours a day.
Let's talk about how you got there in the first place.
Sure.
It was 1993. What happened?
You know,
which I'm sure you've probably thought about, like, what, maybe every day since then.
This is something that I talk about openly and readily, and I've talked about it hundreds, perhaps even thousands of times. And yeah, it's extremely difficult for me to talk about it for a number of reasons. But one of the most difficult things that I have trouble with is talking about it succinctly, because it's not that I ever want to minimize or justify or explain away anything that happened. I never want to offer any excuses for what happened. But I have this, always have this desire to kind of, to give this backstory that some people may feel like is, you know, an excuse in a sense. And for me, the way that I see it is, I didn't come to that point in my life with a blank slate. There were 16 years of life behind me that led me to that point. And how could I talk about that one point in time without at least addressing some of the things that took place in those 16 years? But I do always try to preface what I say with, it's not meant in any way to mitigate my actions, to diminish the harm or the suffering that I inflicted.
I'm sorry.
Because those things are very real to me. And it's important to me that people understand that I am aware of that and work hard every day to make amends for the things that I've done.
So essentially in April of 1993, you were, basically your dad had been sent to prison. You were in a very chaotic home life. Your grades were slipping. You had decided to shut down kind of emotionally. And you and your friend Gator and Nigel go back to Dartmouth High after an initial confrontation where Nigel is beaten up by some kids there, and you decide to go back. You have a pipe, a bat, and a billy club, and mm-hmm. you go into school, and some teachers are looking for you because they see you come back into the school. They know what happened. You guys run into a classroom, mm-hmm. and you see one of the kids that had hurt Nigel earlier, mm-hmm. and then what happens from there?
So Gator exchanged words, basically called out the student for being involved in the earlier altercation. They began arguing for a split second, and then Gator immediately headed toward the young man who was in the back of the classroom at the time. And at that point, the teachers who had grabbed me in the hall, they saw what was going on and immediately pushed me into the room, told me, "Don't move, stay there," and went after Gator. By this point, maybe 5 seconds into this whole situation, the class had already kind of erupted into chaos and turmoil. Gator was chasing this kid, who in turn was being chased by several teachers now at this point. Desks were being tossed around. There was a lot of commotion. And the teachers managed to get to Gator probably within a couple of seconds and tackle him to the floor. Meanwhile, I was standing just inside the doorway, and the entire time I was watching this happen, my mind was racing. I was panicking. The teachers who had grabbed me had taken the pipe away from me, and I had this kind of overwhelming thought that I have to do something, that, you know, we had let things get out of hand, and that it was now my responsibility to send these kids a message. The kid that Gator was chasing circled around the back of the room and was standing a few feet away from me. And I decided that there was no way out for me except to do something. And it wasn't really a clear thought process. The wheels in my mind were spinning pretty rapidly. And so I decided that I had a solution. And so I walked a few feet toward this young man, and I took a knife from my pocket that I had carried probably for 4 or 5 years, and I stabbed him one time in the stomach. And I tried to walk away like nothing happened. And in that split second, I was experiencing horrible conflicting emotion. On the one hand, I felt like, at that age, and again, I don't mean in any way to diminish the outcome of what happened or my actual actions, but on the one hand, I thought I had done this brave and noble thing, that I had done this righteous thing by standing up for my friends. And on the other hand, I was, terrified. I had never really been in any kind of trouble. I had never really been in any kind of direct violent situation like that. I was immediately taken into custody, and I was definitely nervous because I had no idea what the process I was involved in was and what was going to happen. And, the police started talking about, potential charges, and they were talking about attempted murder. And in my head, I was thinking, this is crazy, and there was attempted murder, and that's outlandish, and how can you even say something like that? And
you just thought you were going to hurt this boy, Jason Robinson.
In my mind at that time, I couldn't even connect the two things together, my physical action of stabbing someone and the physical outcome of what that would be. And it may seem, crazy to think that, but I remember, later on when the police were asking me, like, what did you think was going to happen? And I remember not being able to wrap my head around that. And it's like, I never got to that point. I never got to thinking about that. And so they brought me to the police station when I was told I had to wait until my mother came. And again, I was thinking I would certainly be in some kind of trouble, but I didn't think it was anything that significant. An officer came into the cell, and I thought he was going to tell me my mother was there and I could leave. And he said, "I'm sorry to inform you, but the kid that you stabbed has died." And I wish I could say, in that very instant, I was overcome with remorse and sadness and sorrow for him and his family. But I was a self-absorbed, selfish 16-year-old boy, and my first thought was, I'm in so much trouble.
You know, you have a stable job now. You're a homeowner. You were able to go to school. Some folks might say, you know, Jason Robinson's life was taken away and you're able to live a life. What do you say to them?
That's something that I've struggled with mightily throughout my incarceration, the prospect that I would get to go home someday, and Jason wouldn't. And for me, I don't know that there'll ever be a day when I can see things objectively enough to really assess the situation. But the kind of subjective analysis I use is that, you know, the scales of justice, they're never going to be righted. There's a life that was lost that unfortunately no efforts, no matter how Herculean on my part, can ever restore. I can never give back that life, although I would gladly do everything in my power to do that. I can never heal the hurt and loss and brokenness that his family has suffered. I just can't do that. But I have a family of my own who also suffered, who are also victims in this tragedy, and I owe it to them to make the most of everything I have in my life. I owe it to my community. I owe it to society as a whole. And I don't know what my future holds. I don't expect that someday I'm going to change the world, but I know that on a daily basis, I do everything in my power to live a life that is beneficial to all of those with whom my life intersects. And so that's the only thing that I can do. Keeping me in prison doesn't benefit anyone. And that's not coming from some selfish perspective of I enjoy my freedom. I'm a human being. Of course, I enjoy my freedom and try to make the most of it. But my perspective, I try again to always maintain this idea, this focus on doing something productive with my life.
So it sounds essentially like, Carter, your timing here really was not great. I mean, you were accused at a time when the country in Massachusetts was going through this idea of a super predator, a young person who is just a horrible criminal, and so you are convicted when that is sort of the prevailing attitude. And then you're in prison, and you are eligible for parole because it's second degree, but there's something happening in Massachusetts at the time, which is when a parolee named Dominic Sinelli kills a Woburn police officer, and then Governor Deval Patrick fires the entire parole board, and nobody is released on parole. So, Gene, I'm wondering if we go to the parole question. This is a common thing for state lawmakers to react and get tough on crime when there's a big case like a Dominic Sinelli case in Woburn, and this affects all cases like Carter's after that. Does Massachusetts react in a unique way, or do most states do this?
Unfortunately, we don't react in a unique way. All states do this. But I would say a lot of people think that Massachusetts is more liberal on these issues than we actually are. When the parole rate in the state before the Dominic Sinelli case was a fairly healthy parole rate, I don't have it off the top, but it was in the 40-50%, certainly different for county prisoners than for lifers. Lifers would be a little bit lower than the whole mass of parole, but it was what would be considered a healthy rate of parole. After Dominic Sinelli and we had a new chair come in, there was essentially a ban. They decided not to even hear life or parole cases for a period of time while they were figuring things out, quote unquote. And the parole rate at that time dropped precipitously. And the problem with a parole rate dropping is that, number one, prisons are overcrowded. Number two, costs more money. Number three, it is not safer because more people come out of prison wrapping up their sentences instead of being on parole where they're supervised and supported by parole officers. So although it's counterintuitive, actually paroling people makes us safer. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but our parole rate has again returned, for lifers, has returned to a fairly abysmal rate, under 10%.
You're on lifetime parole now, right, Carter?
That is correct.
Yeah. Are you concerned that you could face any sort of backlash from going public with your story?
There's always a concern that people are not going to be as receptive to my experience and my story as obviously as I would want them to be and would hope that they would be. But I think for me, you know, you kind of have that scale, that balance that you have to weigh. And for me, it's more important to tell my story because my story is not that unique. There's, you know, more than 2.5 million people incarcerated across this country who have, they may not have all committed the same crime that I committed, and obviously the vast majority haven't, but the people that are incarcerated in this country have a similar story. They have a similar background. And it's not just the people who are affected directly by the criminal justice system, but all the people who are affected indirectly. You know, there's a couple of great quotes that kind of tell that story better than I could tell it about the importance of getting my story out there, which is the great quote from Frederick Douglass that it's easier to build strong children than to heal broken men. And a quote that's actually on the card that I hand out, which says, if we reform our schools, we will find little reform needed in our prisons. And for me, both of those amount to, we need to have systemic change from the earliest ages in our political, social, economic systems, and we need to have it in our social systems. And the greatest resource we have in all of our social systems are people. People like me who can take my experience, use it in a transformative way to transform myself, and then do what I can to give back. And so I consider it both a responsibility and an honor to be able to tell my story in the hopes that everyone hearing my story can learn from it.
Gene, by all accounts, Carter's story is a success story. Are we saying that the criminal justice system works with
his
story?
I think one of the things that I try to make clear in my book is that Carter and many others succeed in spite of things, not because of them. The numbers of juveniles who go to prisons, to adult prisons, and don't come out the way Carter came out is staggering. And statistics show us that if kids go to juvenile facilities, even though juvenile facilities have problems, still, nationally, statistics show that kids are more likely to get beaten up, they're more likely to get raped, they're more likely to be depressed and have mental health issues. They're more likely to have broken family relationships and less likely to get jobs. So all of the things that Carter is working every minute of his life to achieve is not easy. I do believe there are many other kids who have come through the system who survive and make amazing things of their lives. I think it's important for us to hear those stories, but I don't think we can be deceived by the fact that this does not say that this is the norm.
All right. I want to thank both of you for coming in. Jean Trounstein is a professor at Middlesex Community College and author of the new book, Boy with a Knife, A Story of Murder, Remorse, and a Prisoner's Fight for Justice. Carter Reed is the subject of that book. He was released from prison in 2013. Jean, thank you.
Thank you.
Carter, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
The book, Boy with a Knife, was released in April. You can find more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Cassandra Sunt, Virginia Marshall, and Ashley Bailey. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.